People of Adland, do you know how many listeners you can reach by advertising on a Muddy Knees Media podcast? Loads! Every single episode of Galazzo alone is listened to by nearly 100,000 of those hard-to-reach 25 to 44-year-old men. But we do plenty more shows than that now. We've got The Offside Rule with Kate Borsay, Lindsay Hooper and Hayley McQueen. We've got The Offside Rule WSL Edition, the UK's premier women's football podcast. We've got Series Linked, a podcast that's dripping with celebrities. And then there's the rest of the Totally Football Network, which includes the very lovely thetotallyfootballshow.com. If you'd like to talk about advertising with Muddy Knees Media, drop us a line on sales@muddyneesmedia.com. That's sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And listeners, don't keep the show to yourself. Leave us a review, rate us, share it with your friends, and subscribe wherever you listen to the rest of your podcasts and never miss an episode.
Today, turning up the treble with the remarkable story of Inter's tripletta. 2009-2010, we all know how it ends. But how, via a volcano, some moody Mourinho magic and a missing whistle or two, did Inter become the first Italian side to nail the European treble? Find out in this Golazzo. Inter, Pazza Inter, the self-confessed craziest club in calcio, as their own anthem has it, or indeed had it until they decided to ditch the crazy bit a short time ago. Also, as I mentioned, the only Italian side ever to win the European treble on the 5th, 16th and 22nd of May 2010, bringing home the Scudetto, the Coppa Italia and then the big one, the cup with the ears. Here's James Horngartel.
Hello, James.
And here's Gabriele Marcotti.
Hiya.
2010, Gab. The stars aligning. Inter's centenary season.
Not just the stars, the volcanic ash as well. Mm. And I'm sure we'll get to that. It was absolutely remarkable because I think it was a coming together of so many different things. And I don't know how you feel about this, James, but in the summer, to me, it didn't feel at all like things were the way they should be.
No, even though looking back, Inter had a quite remarkable transfer window. You think of that Eto-Ibrahimovic swap. You think of Schneider, Lucio, Milito.
But that's the thing, Schneider. Mm.
Schneider, who arrives right at the end of the summer. Okay.
This always gets me, is club's plan, everything, you know, world planning. Branca, Mourinho knows exactly what he wants. And the Ritiro starts before the season. I think the season might have even started.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden.
Second week.
Yeah. They're realizing, wait a minute, there's absolutely nobody. I mean, it was bad enough last year when the only people who could actually play were Zlatan and Maicon. And I seen play, like, create something, you know, whatever. But now Zlatan's gone, and there's nobody who can create. Zero. And all of a sudden, they turn to the unhappy, but lovable, likable Dutchman who retired, I think, just last month, Wesley Sneijder, who's told at Real Madrid that, yeah, you had a good season, but you know what? We don't want you. We've signed other people.
I mean, what you're forgetting is this is down in history as the Arnautovic treble.
It's down in history so much. But let's begin by returning to those sultry summer nights of August 2009. That's right, it's the start of Il Campionato 2009-2010. Inter the champions under their new manager, Jose Mourinho, the previous year. Hadn't done too well in Europe, of course. You remember they came up against Man United in the quarters. They went out without managing to score a single goal. And this new Serie A campaign, which was starting off at San Siro against Bari, didn't look too promising either.
Dentro, splendido ancora il suggerimento per Bari!
A 1-1 draw in front of a crowd disgruntled by the sale of Inter's totemic figure, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who Barcelona had taken away, giving Inter in exchange only this Samuel Eto'o guy and 50 million euros. Con l'occhio di poi, as they say, in hindsight, one of the most extraordinary bits of transfer business ever.
I suppose something that we didn't expect from Inter as well, because again, the remarkable thing about that transfer window is, yes, in hindsight, it looks like they nailed everything because pretty much did transform the team that summer. And yeah, this is a recruitment squad in Marco Branca and Pier Arcilio still there, who I don't think had done a lot to gain our confidence really and would subsequently mess up. And I think part of Mourinho's mythology here is that he had a big say in recruitment. It was him who was calling these players, saying, I can persuade them to come and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, it's the outlier, I suppose, in a lot of inter windows.
This is obviously part of the Mourinho mythology, right? If you speak to Mourinho loyalists, or indeed if you listen to him talk, all these wonderful players that they added, you know, Lucio at the back and
Thiago
Milito.
Thiago Motta came in.
Thiago Motta midfield. It was all down to him. He identified the needs, blah, 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 and then he made them by Snyder. That's the Mourinho version of events. The story that other people at the club tell is they did the deal for Milito and Thiago Motta like months earlier. Mourinho wanted to bring in Ricardo Carvalho at the back and was totally opposed to Lucio. And then they ended up with Lucio because they couldn't work a deal for Carvalho. Mourinho, for a long time, wanted Lampard. And then obviously... He didn't come. What? Close enough. And obviously the Eto'o deal was uniquely down to the fact that Zlatan
wanted to go.
Yeah, Zlatan and Mino generally get what they want when they want. Barcelona obviously can't pay for him. They don't put a number on him. You had Eto'o who... People looked at the fact that whether it's 50 million or they say 40 million plus Eto'o, you know, why was Eto'o so cheap? Because he was still Samuel Eto'o. And was coming off a good season as well at Barcelona. But he hadn't signed his new contract because Eto'o felt slighted by the fact that, you know, he was making substantially less money than Barcelona's other stars. So they end up with Eto'o. Basically, none of these things had much to do with Mourinho at all. But to his credit, and you have to give Mourinho credit sometimes, he found a way to balance everything. In his original mind, it was going to be Eto'o with Milito up front.
Right.
And then once they added Wesley Snyder, they realized, wait a minute, Wesley doesn't really run. He doesn't play that often. Samu, you got to go play on the wing.
Right.
And Milito's going to be up front.
So as you say, Snyder arrives right at the end of the transfer window. It's after that 1-1 draw with Bari. And it's in that weird time where Real Madrid every summer seem to pick a really great midfielder and go, actually, we don't need you anymore. So,
well, this really blew up in their faces because the final, which we'll get to, is played between Schneider's Inter and Arjen Robben's Bayern, and both left Real Madrid that summer.
To be fair to Real Madrid, we should also mention that who they signed that summer. That was a summer that Real Madrid went crazy and they signed Cristiano Ronaldo,
Kaká,
and Xabi Alonso, and right. Karim Benzema, and Alvaro Arbeloa. Okay, but... Having added so much, they had to go and shed players, and these guys were shown the door. And they weren't happy. And to their credit, both Robin and Snyder at Inter and later in Turkey really relaunched their careers.
But it's interesting how Inter benefited essentially from the transfer largesse of the two Spanish giants. Barca coming in for Ibra did Inter a huge favour, as did the surplus to requirements nature now of Snyder, who slots straight in. Mourinho puts him straight in as a number 10. And his first game is the derby with Milan, and Inter win 4-0. Hello, looks like something might be happening here. You've got an extraordinary squad who somehow Branca has either inherited or helped assemble. The likes of Zanetti, of course, Julio Cesar at the back, Stankovic, Maicon, you mentioned, Walter Samuel, Cordoba, Matrix.
And look, Inter that season also had a whole bunch of good fortune go their way. But let's not forget as well, the year before, obviously you mentioned Inter won the title the year before. Mm. The record books show that they'd won the title the previous 4 years. Obviously, we know what happened, 2005-06, they were handed the title. 2 years after that, they won it with Mancini, but everybody else was still down and Juventus were coming back up or whatever. The year before, I think I probably saw, all right, it's not the most horrible Inter team that I remember because... I remember Mazzarri's Inter and other things too. Hodgson's Inter sometimes. But it was the worst good Inter. Inter won the league in 2008-09 where the entire game plan consisted of lump the ball to Zlatan or let Maicon run with it until he loses it or gives it to Zlatan. You know, either way. It was almost as if Mourinho had made such a big deal when he came to Italy about how, you know, oh, well, you know, tactically it doesn't get any better than this. And, you know, I'm going to show that I'm good enough. And so all that mattered to him was winning. He did nothing to really set the base for anything, nothing for the squad to develop. Then he loses Zlatan. And so I thought, all right, you know, this is where you get exposed. But again, to his credit, and he didn't sign the players, you know, he'll take credit for them and whatever. He got them and he found a way to make it work.
So what is the team that he fashions then, James? Is defensive discipline, huge tactical versatility on the part of the players, and a wonderful fast break?
Yeah, I think they still look to Maicon to take them up the pitch, get them out of trouble. They had Thiago Motta, who I think a lot of people had written off when he left Barcelona and had resurrected his career at Genoa as not a complete midfielder, but someone who could dictate tempo, get a passing game going, and would subsequently become really important, not only for Inter, but for the national team. And then Milito as well, who joined from Genoa, with Bonucci going the other way, famously. And Milito, I would say, is, I'm not going to call him underrated, but in terms of the goals he scored throughout his career, the big games he delivered in, his ability to play on the shoulder, he had a kind of short burst of pace. He wasn't a quick player, but he had quite good acceleration, and he was just very efficient scorer in that, you know, he's not like Cristiano Ronaldo at the moment, who'll take 15 shots a game and look to score once or twice. He would have 4 or 5 shots and he would score, and he'd hit a wall, he would always hit the target. And that combination of him and Eto and Schneider pulling the strings behind made them a difficult proposition for teams to play against. But this is the thing with this Inter side, they are remembered as the "we didn't want the ball" team from Barcelona in the Camp Nou, which I don't think is entirely fair.
No, but equally, the base formation was a 4-2-3-1, which, you know, whether it's attack, and you look on paper, and you say, let's not forget, in the first half of the season, as James said, it was Milito followed by a line of Itzo, Schneider, and a young man named Super Mario Balotelli. So if I were Duncan Castles, I'd say, well, wait a minute, you dare you call him defensive? He's playing 3 center forwards, right, plus Schneider. And then the two behind, 2 out of Cambiaso, Dicky Stankovic, and Motta. Though Motta, of course, did it the Motta way, so he's injured all the time. But then you look at it, and this is the remarkable thing, and this is Itzo, why he's so fantastic, is he got Itzo to say, listen, you're going to be on the wing. You're going to have to do all the running and all the defensive work. Tried to do it with a chap on the other side too, Balotelli, thinking it's going to be easy because Balotelli's younger and blah, 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 more energy. Worked to a point, and that's why you saw Balotelli starting to disappear from the team.
Then you have that tantrum against Barcelona, no, which I think marked the end of his time. Yeah.
Well, Goran Pandev arrived in January. And
Freeing himself from Lazio.
Another young talent.
The mobbing.
That's right. Yeah. Pandev, who only arrived because they had a weird situation where he wouldn't sign a new contract, and so Lotito put him on the naughty step. And with Pandev, because, you know, you could go to a guy like Pandev and say, hey, Pandev, listen, this is Inter and you're Goran Pandev. You're just going to sit and defend. And that's what he did. And between him and Itzo, it gave enough cover so that Schneider could kind of do what Schneider did. But even then, I think Schneider only played like 25 league games or something that year. You know, there's this idea that Schneider was there in big moments, but he was often in and out of the side. And often when he was out, they would add a third central midfielder.
Right. So many players stand out from that season. As you mentioned, though, Milito. It's hard to think of anyone key. His goals, the Coppa Italia win, that was his goals. The game which won them, the Scudetto, his goal.
2 in the Champions League final.
And then the final, a brace from him.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, he didn't make the Ballon d'Or shortlist. The thing with Eto is that when Benitez ended up replacing Mourinho and doing the kind of Clough to Revy, we can win better than you did, he obviously thought that Eto was going to put the same shift in and be a fullback again. And Eto was like, no, maybe for a year. I'm not doing that again. Although I think he did have his best ever year under Benitez. I think he scored 37 goals. Yeah,
but tough to inherit a team that's just won pretty much everything.
Oh, and this is the larger point, James, about this Inter side, is that, yes, they brought in a lot of new players that summer, but for the core group, it was their last chance. They had been a part of this Inter side for a long time. You mentioned this is the year 5 of them winning 5 Scudetti in a row, if you count the one that they were given after Calciopoli. And also for the owner, Massimo Moratti, this was fulfillment. This was the dream come true. He didn't feel like he had to do anything. He could walk away having been the sugar daddy and financed the team out of the family oil company's pocket without there being any commercial operation there. So, you know, at the end of the end of that season, they've got a really old squad and loads of big losses. And, yeah, Inter have been in the mess that they've been in ever since, and they're only now just coming out of it. Campionato di calcio
italiano. You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
The Scudetto that year came and they'd won them before, and it was close in the end with Roma. The Coppa Italia also won over Roma. Europe, though, I think, especially because it's Inter, Pazzi Inter, the serial bottlers, a team that was drawn in a group with Barcelona, the ultimate side of that era, and you know, still to this day, one of the greatest. An Inter team who, when they went to Kiev in November, still hadn't won a Champions League game, were bottom of the group, and in that game were 5 minutes from essentially losing that match and losing any chance of going through to the knockout stages. That whole road to the final, the idea that they would go and become European champions, I think in November, just seemed ludicrous.
Yeah, without doubt. And yeah, even on the back of what we'd seen from them the year before, that Mourinho didn't seem able to change the DNA of this club, or the DNA that had materialized over since the 60s. But that game, you're absolutely right to bring it up, because it was the key turning point.
So this is Kiev in November, as we say, game week four of the Champions League, and Dinamo Kiev have taken the lead through, worst of all, Mourinho's old nemesis, Shevchenko.
Well, and Inter's old nemesis.
And former Milan man, of course. And then, 86th minute, with Inter really on the verge of disaster, who should pop up with a goal but Diego Milito? And they follow that with Wesley Sneijder.
This is what Sneijder would kind of establish a reputation for over the course of that season was... Yeah, Gab's right. He wasn't always in the team, but he would come up with big moments and he'd score late. I seem to remember there was that crazy game they had against Siena where he came up with the winner late, and against Udinese as well. That was very much kind of Wes's thing. And, you know, given how late he arrived, the derby essentially arrives the night before, plays an instrumental part in that. That was very much set the tone for his kind of Inter career, if you like.
Well, Inter qualified then for the knockout stages, and in the round of 16... they meet some more old friends, Chelsea, for two memorable encounters. It is, of course, Jose Mourinho's first trip back to Stamford Bridge. And as I recall, this is the first time that we see the likes of Samuel Eto'o playing as a fullback to essentially shut down the Premier League side. Inter goes through, but what I also remember from these two ties was how much help they got from the officials. Two massive penalty shouts for Chelsea. The first leg, Walter Samuel on Kalou, before Cambiasso comes up with that brilliant goal. Second leg, when Drogba essentially gets wrestled to the ground again by Walter Samuel.
You know who remembers that very well, too?
Who?
Mr. Carlo Ancelotti.
Because he was managing Chelsea.
Because of the way, obviously, things ended at Chelsea. He's had so many big games, there's so many sort of regrets and stuff. But I think that encounter still ranks in his, you know, probably top three he'd love to have back. Because remember, too, Ancelotti doesn't normally pick fights against people, but Mourinho, he's all friendly with Mourinho, and they text each other now. But at the time, Mourinho was giving everybody stick, especially anybody who had any association with Chelsea, not named Jose Mourinho, or indeed Roman Abramovich, because you always have to kiss up to him. So there was a ton of needle there. People expected Ancelotti to kick on. And everything broke Inter's way in that game, and that rankled. But it was a sign of things to come, because as we go through these rounds, now, there is an argument, though, that God giveth and God taketh away, because even as Inter were advancing through the Champions League, they were absolutely collapsing in Serie A, which is one of those things that every time Mourinho goes and like mocks people, like say Ancelotti, when he says, oh, he's won two Champions League titles, oh yeah, that's special. But several people have done that. But there's only one person who ever, you know, was 3-0 up at halftime and then finished 3-3. Whenever he mocks people for collapsing, you should probably remember the time his team were 11 points clear of Roma and then all of a sudden were 2 points back.
Right.
Because that 13-point swing was absolutely remarkable. And there was a real sense around the club that, okay, Mourinho's going to run out of luck He got past Chelsea. He'll get knocked out in the quarterfinals, certainly in the semifinals. And yet they kept going. But there was a sense around that time that he was going to be hounded out of Milan because you don't give up an 11-point lead.
The press in particular.
I mean, Mancini had tried his best in...
Yeah, exactly.
in and his final season
not
as
just
well.
That, but again, karma. Who was he giving up the 11-point lead to? Mr. Claudio Ranieri at Roma. The same guy he had mocked because he couldn't speak English, because Ranieri was too old. What is he, 70 years old? All this stuff.
Yeah, we should say that Mourinho, in terms of his charisma, I suppose, was a big part of this two-year spell in Italy. Although while he's still seen as this... Yeah, he's so revered over there, you know, and it's
but
like...
What would you say he is? Because with the press in Italy seemed to be, of all the countries he's worked in, I mean, certainly until he went to Spain, that seemed to be the one place where his charm didn't work on the press.
He came to blows with Andrea Ramazzotti at the Corriere dello Sport. And famously, I think...
Can I just explain why he came to blows with him?
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
So at the time, in sort of the bowels of San Siro... It wasn't at San Siro, was it? Because they were all getting on the bus.
Bergamo, was it?
It was somewhere else. But basically, like, the players would get out of the dressing room and go to the bus. And to avoid chaos, in addition to the sort of the mix zone area, Inter's press office basically allowed one guy to act as a pool reporter with a proviso that he would share the quotes with everybody else to go and stand next to the door of the bus and try to stop people and get quotes as they went on the bus, rather than having a whole scrum of people. So they sent this guy, Andrea Ramazzotti, who's this tall, goofy guy with glasses. He always wore these nice pinstripe suits because, because you know why? It's because his dad is a tailor. That's why.
Okay.
And then the Inter Milan press officer says, okay, you stand here, right? And what happens, Mourinho sees him, gets off the bus, and starts manhandling him out of the way. And again, I think Mourinho said, oh yeah, I knew perfectly well he was authorized to be there, but you know, I needed to shake things up, you know? And this is the kind of stuff Mourinho was doing. Right. You know, but I don't know how you feel about this, but I think from like a WWE smack talk kind of way, my biggest regret is that Mourinho came to Serie A a little too late. You know, he came to Serie A at a point when, like, you know, Moggi was gone, Capello was gone, like all kind of like the psychos, Mazzone, the whole war of words thing. And when he got there, you know, you had basically a bunch of relatively nice guys.
He was able to, like, mispronounce Beretta's name, Banetta, which he'd later do with Tito Villanova and Pito Villanova. Yeah. But in terms of sound bites, these sound bites are still used all the time. Intellectual prostitution, il rumore dei nemici. What else did he come? I mean,
one of the big things he did was
Zero Titoli.
Mario Sconcerti, who's perhaps sort of the dean of Italian journalists and my old boss. He was on Sky Italia, and they do these sort of the two ways after games with, like, the studio analysts. He's one of them. And Mourinho comes on, you know, it was after a poor performance or whatever. This might have been in his first season. Scogetti asked him a question which Mourinho doesn't like.
Io so perché già mi hanno detto che lei è suo amico. No,
io sono amico di tutti. Sono anche amico suo.
Mio non è sicuramente.
No.
Mourinho's like, oh, I know why you're criticizing me. And he just says, why? Like, because you're Roberto Mancini's friend, are you? You're his big mate, so you're having a go at me. And Sconcerti says, no, I'm everybody's friend. Whereas, really, as a member of the media, he should have said, I'm nobody's friend. Every week, you had some sort of sideline issue. And again, it's obviously followed Mourinho throughout his career. I think it probably reached a nadir in terms of normal human behavior in Madrid. But you had this sense that Inter was just this tinderbox ready to explode.
They draw CSKA in the quarterfinals, and that goes relatively well. I think 2-1-0 wins, and they're through. But next up, they're facing Barcelona again. First leg at San Siro, 31st of March of that year, and I don't think many people give the Nerazzurri much of a chance. Barcelona, the season before, had won 6 titoli, 6 trophies. Barcelona in the group stage, Inter hadn't managed to lay a glove on them. 2 group games, one finishing 0-0, the other 2-0 to the Catalans. But here comes something you've hinted at before, Gab, another crucial development, this time from the north. Eyjafjallajökull, a.k.a. the Icelandic volcano. an eruption whose effects were huge. Supposedly, according to Sam Allardyce, it was the ash cloud and its effect on the European flypaths which prevented Blackburn Rovers from signing
Robert Lewandowski.
Yeah. And how, you know, the world would have been a different place had that happened.
Yeah.
But it also meant, with flights cancelled all over Europe at the end of that March, bad news for Barcelona.
Yeah, they had to get the bus.
So they're due to play at San Siro, and flights are off, and they wait and they wait and they wait because they're hoping it's going to clear. And eventually they have to make a call, and the call is to get on a coach and make a 14-hour journey across the motorways of the south of France and then into Italy to Milan a short time before the game. Now, I can't remember what day they arrived. I think it was the day before the match.
Yeah, it was obviously the worst possible preparation. I think there was also issues with the coach and the speed of travel. There was a whole bunch of other things they could have done. And again, with hindsight, if you talk to them, I mean, one obvious thing, somebody actually offered, like, you know what, I have a hovercraft. Why don't you just shoot across from Barcelona to Genoa and then just hop on the train? But again, the train, you know. But yeah, the volcano ash was absolutely massive, clearly played a part in this. I remember it very well because I was on holiday in Tenerife when it hit.
You're always on holiday, you're in a volcanic island.
But you know what it meant was a 10-day holiday. We were in Tenerife for a whole month.
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious, because it just hit just at the wrong time. There were so many other people with canceled flights. Our insurance was paying for it anyway. So, yeah, we ended up staying there a very, very long time. But Inter 1-3-1, there's still controversy around the goals. I think it was Milito's goal that Pep would still say was offside. Mourinho would say that it wasn't. And somehow they come away with a 3-1 win. But I think there was still a sense among most people that when they go back the other way, shoes on the other foot, yeah, Barcelona are going to absolutely go and roast them.
So it's only a week later that they go to Camp Nou. And I think everyone, I mean, the Camp Nou is buzzing because everyone thinks it's going to be the remontada. They're up against the greatest attacking side of that time, probably one of the greatest attacking sides the world's ever seen. Xavi, Iniesta, Messi, classic Barcelona
and
stuff.
Zlatan.
Yeah. And plan B, Zlatan.
This is really the, you can shove your possession stats up your arse kind of game.
But the numbers are extraordinary. But this then is their finest hour. This is probably Mourinho's finest hour in many ways. This is the defining match of that treble season.
Well, because they go down to 10 men early because of cheating Sergi Busquets.
So this is the game of the Busquets peak.
He goes down a little bit softly, contact with Thiago Motta, rolls around, and you can see him just peeking through his hands, and Motta gets sent off, and it becomes Inter at the Alamo, essentially. And I think one of the, again, we're talking about Mourinho being controversial, how he communicated. I think a few weeks beforehand, they played Sampdoria.
The Manete.
They'd gone down to 10 men, then they'd gone down to 9 men, and they managed to hold on and I think get a draw in that
game. They got a clean sheet, yeah.
And Mourinho famously made the handcuff gesture. Yeah, they're trying to tie my hands. They're trying to stop us from winning. And they will say that the mentality that was kind of forged, it was already being forged, but from that game, when they went down to 10 at the Camp Nou, they knew they could get through it, essentially, because they could point to past precedent, well, recent past precedent.
And this was the defining game of the we don't want the ball. Barcelona, in those 90 minutes, completed 555 passes. Inter managed 67. Barcelona's possession ranked
50 from Julio Cesar just whacking the ball.
Probably, yeah. Inter's possession was a whopping 14%. And they ended up losing the game 1-0. But that was still enough
in the final 10 minutes.
Yeah, that was Piqué, no?
Yeah.
And Barcelona did have reasons to recriminate in that game too. But what I thought was interesting and what was pretty genius about that game was that Barcelona side was known for a ton of pressing, right? Whenever they lost the ball, which wasn't often because they had crazy possession stats, they'd always kind of converge. And if you didn't win the ball back within 3 seconds of the early version, you would foul. And so what Inter did in that game, and if you go back and watch this again, it's pretty remarkable. Ball to Sanetti, ball to Maicon. They wouldn't try to pass out and try to, you know, try to break the press, or they wouldn't hit it into space for, was it Milito who was still on, or whoever it was to run onto? No, they would run with the ball and wait for the foul. And time and again, boom, boom, boom. And Guardiola spoken about this, about his evolution, that he didn't realize that this was the plan. Because what would happen was, Maicon would get fouled, and then he'd sit on the floor, and then he would get up slowly, and then he would look around. And every time they fouled, and I don't know what the final foul count is, but if you adjust foul count per minutes of possession. It's something like, they fouled like sort of every 40 seconds when they didn't have the ball. It's completely insane. It allowed Inter to take so much of the sting out of the game. And that's why even though people today complain that Guardiola's teams foul too much or whatever, if you notice, they do it in different areas, they do it in different situations. And Guardiola himself has said that this is sort of an evolution from it, something he picked up from that game, that, you know, if the other team doesn't want the ball and they're happy with the result, you can't just keep applying this tactic of I'll gamble and either win the ball or foul, because it's not going
to
work.
But it was a shocking game to watch, because I'm sure people have tried to play that kind of or take that kind of approach to a match before. But it was remarkable to see it in such stark contrast to Barcelona's approach in such a huge game, and to be so successful and hard for Barca to answer.
It was, and I feel a bit uncomfortable sticking up for Mourinho too much in this, but it wasn't just eight men in the box. There was a method to what Inter did when they got the ball back. It wasn't just like, I mean, it certainly felt like they were hanging on by dear life, but there was a method to it, and it was very, very effective. And I think, you know, Mourinho should maybe get a tiny bit of credit for that.
There's a great video on YouTube where Mourinho actually breaks down, particularly the first leg, the coach's voice. And, I mean, it is very impressive.
I remember after the game, the press was telling about using a word. In Italy, they were using the word gabbia. The real translation is about like a jail to Messi, because in the end, we didn't play man-to-man. But Zanetti, Mota, Cambiasso, everybody was responsible for any position that Messi could go. Even if Messi sometimes was trying to go more to this side here, he would always go, and then Schneider was going to close. So our defensive approach was based on this positional problem.
Let's not kid ourselves. You replay this game 100 times, sure, Barcelona win 98 or 99 times.
I'm not so sure. You know, there are other games, like, say, Roma's Romontada, that I think Barcelona might win. But this one, I'm not sure how many answers they'd have. I think that Inter could go out there and do that again. That principle of if we don't have the ball, we can't make any mistakes, we can't get drawn out of position, they can't find a way through. They didn't luck their way through in that game. The season was unbelievably lucky. But I think that game, they came up with an answer.
Was there... At the end of that game, was there a goal disallowed which perhaps should not have been disallowed? Was it Bojan? Also, like, immediately after the...
Yeah, Bojan Krčić, yeah.
Immediately after Motta was sent off, Julio César made an incredible save from Messi. But ultimately, this game has been so defining in that rivalry between Mourinho and Guardiola, what one is and what one's not. And one of the iconic Mourinho moments, running onto the pitch.
The sprinklers turning.
Pointing to the Inter fans in the top end, and the sprinklers coming on.
After which comes the final against Bayern, who also were chasing a treble that year. But, it was a pretty clear-cut affair, this final.
Even though Louis van Gaal felt differently about it. Yes, he argued that they deserved to win, that they played better football, Mourinho's anti-football. Give it the whole sort of odious van Gaal thing that he does. And I will say this, right? If this had been sort of Barcelona van Gaal from 1998 talking, I would have said fair play to you in a bad Irish accent. But this was Bayern version of van Gaal, who was sort of part of his, like, sort of devolution into United version of van Gaal.
Mourinho gave it that spiel, as he did when United beat Ajax in the Europa League final a couple of years ago, which was within a minute or two of the game starting, he knew they were going to win.
Right.
Well, the Ajax one was easier because he was coaching against Peter Bosz. So he probably knew that when the draw was made.
A 2-0 victory, both goals from, of course, Il Principe Diego Milito.
The second one's magnificent. Milito, una finta, in area, ancora! Il Principe! Diego Milito! La firma lui! Probabilmente questa finale, questa coppa, è 2-0! Il Principe diventa re nella notte di Madrid!
His final stats are equally impressive that year. 30 goals for Milito in 52 games, four of which directly counted for the treble. I mean, he effectively won the treble.
We need to remind ourselves of what happened after the final, which I'm sure is a story I've told before.
Well, topping the charts at that moment, as Inter win there at the Bernabeu, is Se Fosse Per Sempre, If It Was Forever, by Italian rock star and massive Inter fan Biagio Antonacci. who happened to be in the crowd at the Bernabeu. But it wasn't for sempre, though, Gab, was it? It wasn't even for 30 minutes.
No, and you know what? Sometimes in this profession, you get to go and you get to witness history in the making, not just on the pitch, but off it. And it'll be one of those defining moments that I will never forget. In the bowels of the Bernabeu, there's the mix zone, and then there's sort of this tunnel that, like, the select few who are allowed to park there kind of drive through to get out of the ground. And we've done most of our interviews. Most of the interplayers are on the bus, and you're watching through this kind of through almost like a chain link fence, but it was made of concrete, but with holes in it. And I can see Marco Materazzi, and he's all sad, and he's standing, leaning against the wall next to the bus. And there's a car that comes out of the side garage and starts making its way towards the entrance. I heard the car screech to a halt, and then I saw the door fling open, and I see Jose Mourinho jump out of the car and run towards the inter-team bus. In my mind, Mourinho, moments earlier, inside the car with Florentino Perez, you know, just screaming and saying, like, stop, you have to stop, you have to stop.
But I think that's pretty much what happened.
Okay, I didn't personally witness that.
But he's got into Real Madrid's car moments after winning, because that's what he's going to do. He's going to leave the club and go to Real Madrid. As he's leaving the Bernabeu, he sees Matrix there in floods of
and
tears.
He enters the Matrix, as we all do from time to time.
He says, stop the car.
Stops the car, runs over to the little sidewalk where Matrix is. This is the bit you can see on YouTube. And he goes, and he's sobbing. He is sobbing in the Matrix's arm. The Matrix, who he sent, I think he came on for 1 minute. By this point,
he came on 91st minute.
Yes. The Matrix, by the way, the only player in history to have won a World Cup and a European Cup, despite never having represented his country at any youth level, which I think is pretty freaking cool.
Right?
Yeah. And the Matrix to this day is, I mean, I would say, like, the Matrix and Duncan Castles are the two ultimate Mourinho loyalists who would give their organs for him. And he just sobs. And at one point you see the Matrix sort of leaning away and Mourinho sort of gripping to him. And I have often debated. Mourinho knew there were cameras there and everybody was watching.
You cynic, Gap.
But I'll tell you what, if he was faking that moment of climax with Marco Materazzi, you know, he's Robert De Niro.
So post 22nd of May 2010, what happened?
Well, James, the spell is broken insofar as whilst Mourinho and Matrix were in this kind of embrace, you also had Diego Milito saying, in football, you never know. I've got a big offer. We'll see.
Where did he go?
Well, he didn't, but at the same time, that did not go down particularly well with Inter, his owner. And this is another big mistake that Moratti makes after this, in that he looks at the squad, they're his heroes, they've made his dream come true. And even though they're all like in their mid-30s, he's like, you know what, I'm going to give you long contract extensions on exorbitant money.
But
you're my boys.
It's amazing what you do when we're playing with somebody else's money.
Well, but it was his own money.
It wasn't his own money. It's not
money.
It's his Moratti money.
It's the Moratti
money. That's his dad's money, and it's his brother's money, and they put him in this little box at Inter and kind of go play in that sandbox where the sand is made of little broken down gold nuggets so you don't come over and help with the real family business.
Well, that's one version of the Moratti story, but one of the more sympathetic City owners, I would say.
He uses himself.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's a lovely guy, and he was chasing a dream for so long. His dad,
45 years.
Angelo Moratti was the famous Inter European title at 65, and he'd spent all these years chasing it. He'd spent nobody in world football had spent more money than Massimo Moratti trying to get the Nerazzurri back up there.
Did you remember there's that viral kind of graphic going around Twitter about
the highest spending teams and Inter just until you get the explosion of the Abu Dhabi lot, then they're just so far, even above Abramovich, which is incredible. But he was very much the last of a dying breed, a bygone era of Italian owners.
Well, you just know that were Massimo Moratti still the president of Inter, Mario Icardi would still be captain and still be at the club.
Yeah, and Ricoba would be coach. Yeah, yeah. He sold up anyway in 2016.
Ricoba would be playing.
He sold up in 2016. Mourinho dedicated the victory as he departed the Bernabeu to the Moratti family. On field, you had Javier Zanetti in tears. He finally retired in 2014 after amassing 858 appearances for Inter. He's now vice president at the club.
Yeah. He tore his Achilles in that season under Mazzarri and was out for a long time.
I blame Mazzarri, obviously.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. But his comeback game was Moratti's final game, which, wow, given he was his first signing with Lambaudi or Rambert,
Sebastian Rambert, El Avioncito, and soon thereafter, Roberto Carlos, wow, who, as we all know, after 1 year in Serie A, new manager comes in, says, yeah, I don't think this guy can quite cut it in Serie A, and sells him. And that man, of course, was
Roy Hodgson.
To be fair
to Roy Hodgson.
Yes, let's hear the excuses. And from that moment, from the moment Roberto Carlos left, which is the day that Inter died, by the way,
so
Inter had about 89 different left backs.
Yes, that's true. But given your point earlier about whether Mourinho takes credit or not for assembling all these players, is it fair to suggest that transfer activity under Roy Hodgson was actually conducted by Roy Hodgson? I don't think so. Not the way Inter were run.
Still Roy Hodgson truther.
I think if you ask Roy Hodgson, he will say that this was one of the mistakes he made. I think he will own.
I've asked him about it, and he denied. He said it wasn't his decision.
Maybe he likes to lie to you and tell the truth to me.
That's very possible. Anyway,
Roy, if you're listening,
along,
let us know. No, because obviously, we have this great expression in Italy, which is success has many fathers, failure is an orphan.
Yeah,
you know. So obviously, nobody.
Say in Italian.
It's just a molti padri, fallimento e orfano. There's a better way of saying it.
Yeah,
but look, I mean,
it's like the mother of idiots is always pregnant.
That's so true.
Yeah, but that's a whole other thing.
No, no. Now, returning to that Inter, Julian Cesar takes the dream move to QPR. He's now a TV pundit.
Yeah, I saw him in Singapore.
Oh, did you?
Lovely man.
Mm. Julian Cesar, who, of course, was married to, possibly still is married to,
Ronaldo's ex.
There you go.
Are they still together? Milena.
Susanna.
Oh, sorry, Susanna Werner. No, it wasn't Susanna Werner. It was the one after.
Or the one before. Who knows? Okay. Anyway, it's a very attractive blonde
Ronaldo's
Brazilian
ex.
Lady.
It was Susanna Werner then.
I think it was Susanna, yeah.
Yeah. Maicon, I think, might still be playing as far away from Gareth Bale as possible.
Maicon,
that's
so harsh.
That is harsh and mean and unnecessary. Maicon, who was named for which Hollywood actor?
Michael Douglas.
There you go.
Walter Samuel, do you know where he is now? You probably do.
Yes, he's coaching in Argentina.
Well, he's coaching Argentina. He's part of Scaloni's.
He's part of the backroom staff. And
which
whose
is amazing, though.
And whose nickname was?
The Wall.
The Wall.
The Wall.
And he was the guy who always used to make the mate and also grill the steak, the asado, for the big cookouts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cambiasso went to Leicester, who, timing, were the only one of his clubs that he didn't win the league title at because he went the wrong year.
No, not just that. It's he went to Leicester and then he left. He wanted to stay and then they weren't sure and stuff. Ranieri was coming, blah, blah, blah. And then he ended up leaving, but it was very touch and go.
Wesley Snyder retired without ever making that move to Man United, which is a shame because we'd love to have seen that. And Samuel Eto'o.
He retired and he got really big really quickly.
Mm.
Happens.
Samuel Eto'o did one more year with the Nerazzurri and then had a really busy time. He went to Andzi Mashkashkala.
In Dagestan, but he didn't actually play in Dagestan because it was a war-torn area. So they all lived in
Moscow.
They lived in Moscow. You should fly down for games and fly straight back up.
At the time, he was said to have become the world's highest paid player, but Lord knows how that all worked. From there, he actually went to Chelsea, Everton, and Sampdoria. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, and there was that crazy story about him going to buy that haunted villa. Do you remember that?
Which haunted villa?
While you look it up, can I just say Samuel Eto'o, 22 years as a professional, 13 clubs, 4 league titles, 3 Champions League titles, 2 Africa Cup of Nations, 1 gold medal. Always number one in the hearts of all right-minded and right-thinking, God-fearing people. Like
excellent.
Me.
And finally hung up his boots this August 2019.
Luckily never did buy the Villa Alta Chiara. Near Portofino. It once belonged to Lord Carnarvon, who was the financial backer for Howard Carter.
Yeah,
ever since
the curse of Tutankhamun.
Let's not talk about it. This makes me uncomfortable.
Okay. All right. Well, thank goodness he didn't buy that. As for Inter, the last Italian club to win the Champions League.
Yeah, and the only one to do the treble, which is why they sing this song to Juventus fans these days. How come you never win the Champions League?
Into the last side from Italy to win that competition, possibly the next. Who knows? We shall see. But that brings us to the end of this special dedicated to one of the most remarkable Coppa di Campioni or Champions League victories ever. Many thanks to Gabriele Marcotti and James Horncastle. Do join us again for more fun times. For now, though, from all of us here, it's a arrivederci. Campionato di
calcio italiano. You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.